Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 21st of March. I'm Karina.
And I'm Max Nominacher. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to the listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5.03 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are Karina Bism's story on the TED and TEDx Terry Talks, as well as Moore Mazanke's report on the connection between the Fukushima disaster and the Relay for Life.
We also have today's hot topic discussing UBC student opinions on a recent law passed in Idaho which limits the right to record or film animal abuse. Today's show also features CITR's campus coordinator CJ, who has got a segment on the UBC students who took part in the nationwide 5 days for the homeless campaign that took place from March 9 to 14th.
Later in the program, Alice Dare Melling hosts a report and roundtable on the English changes and how it can adapt. And now, some headlines for today. In campus news, for the first time in over a decade, the Genocide Awareness Project, or GAP, will not be coming to UBC's campus. The project, which is sponsored by UBC Lifeline, a pro-life club at UBC, is known to hold protests equating abortion to genocide using graphic imagery to state their claim. Instead of the GAP, Lifeline hosted an event this last Wednesday called Silent No More, where they brought speakers to talk about their experience with abortion. Critics have said that this approach is based on shaming, much like the approach taken by The Gap. Furthermore, the departure of The Gap will likely not mean that graphic images of abortion won't be seen on campus. Lifeline says that they plan to host an event called Choice Chain, where they plan to hold up photos of aborted fetuses and talk to passersby about abortion. These events will be held once a week for the last 2 weeks of the school year.
UBC has fired men's hockey coach Milan Dragicevic. Dragicevic has been the T-Birds coach for the last 12 seasons. He was Canada West Coach of the Year in 2012 and led the team to the playoffs 9 times. Dragicevic was fired Monday in the wake of the UBC Sport Review, in which the team retained their varsity status but was left to pursue hybrid funding. UBC acquires 1.2 million photo collection. A set of rare photos from the early days of British Columbia will be digitized and made public thanks to a $1.2 million gift from a Vancouver art collector to the University of British Columbia. The collection, donated by Juno and Diane Langman, consists of more than 18,000 rare early photographs from the 1850s to the 1970s. It is considered the, quote, premier private collection of early provincial photos and in an important illustrated history of early photograph methods. Sorry. Photos from the collection include such timeless pieces as hurdy-gurdy girls outside the Barkerville Saloon selling dances to Mina for $1, which is from 1867, a couple skating on Trout Lake, and troops departing New Westminster for the war. The photo collection can be viewed online at news.ubc.ca.
In local news, there's an activity that's transforming the lives of people living with a disability: riding a horse. Therapeutic riding programs provide benefits thanks to the gentle rhythm of the horse and the bond that exists between horse and rider. One such program is in Vancouver. UBC School of Journalism student Daryl Hall reports more on this.
Venture down to Vancouver's Southlands neighborhood, and you'll no doubt come across a horse and rider being led down the street by someone wearing a bright yellow vest. That would be a volunteer with the Southlands Therapeutic Riding Society, or STARS for short. STARS is one of only a handful of therapeutic riding programs offered in the Lower Mainland.
Pretty much every place has a waiting list. It's very popular. Studies have started to really show the benefits of therapeutic riding.
Megan McDonald is the head instructor and one of two certified therapeutic riding instructors with STARS. With the help of a large team of dedicated volunteers, the program helps some 35 students experience the power of the horse. They include people with MS, muscular dystrophy, brain injuries, or serious self-image problems. About half have autism or are in the autism spectrum, with people with autism being shown to have a strong affinity for animals. In her 10 years as an instructor, Megan has seen big changes in her students.
A big thing is confidence for some of our riders, so riders that are able to go from quite a negative self-image to starting to have positive self-talk.
One of those students is Rachel Roberts. She was one of the first riders at STARS. Rachel has cerebral palsy and is normally confined to her wheelchair.
I try and not let it get me down because I know I can ride a horse, so yeah.
Of all the therapies that she has tried, none can compare with getting on a horse.
I train, I walk, I swim, I do lots of stuff. I kayak, but riding is my favorite part, favorite thing in the whole world.
On this day, Rachel is riding a 23-year-old Appaloosa named Sprite. A custom-built ramp allows her to get from her wheelchair to the horse with the help of the volunteers. Inside the ring, her instructor provides encouragement and instruction as she completes a variety of maneuvers.
Straight to the letter F. F. Forward impulsion. Hands forward. Yes, Rachel. Very good.
The confident rider who circles the ring today is a far cry from the one who first got on a horse over 10 years ago.
When I first started riding Sprite, I was very forward and like couldn't sit up straight, and now I can sit up straight and steer him and do a little bit of work off lead, and it's freedom. Yeah.
Now she has her sights set on representing Canada at the Paralympics one day. Today, though, the lesson ends too soon for Rachel, as it always does.
I don't normally like to get off the horse.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm the same.
Come on.
Rachel gives Sprite a big treat and an even bigger hug, showing the special bond that only a horse and rider know. Daryl Hall, Thunderbird News, Vancouver.
Families of Robert Picton victims to receive $15,000 each. 11 of the 13 families involved in a civil suit against the City of Vancouver, the provincial government, and federal government have agreed to a $50,000 settlement. The civil suit was launched last May, claiming that police and the Crown failed to adequately warn women in the downtown East Side that a serial killer may have been on the loose. It also raised concerns about the ways that the families of missing women were informed that they were all linked to the Picton case. Jason Gradle, one of the lawyers representing the children of the victims, says that while not all of the families are happy with the settlement, 11 of the suit's 13 have agreed to its terms.
In national news, Finance Minister Jim Flaherty resigned earlier this week. Flaherty's resignation came suddenly as he announced that he would be returning to work in the private sector. He has been one of Canada's longest acting finance ministers after spending nearly 8 years in cabinet. In a statement, Flaherty thanked Prime Minister Stephen Harper, saying, quote, "We achieved great things for Canada, and I could never have accomplished what I have as finance minister without the full support of Prime Minister Harper." New finance minister Joe Oliver will inherit a budget on the brink of balance with the lowest business tax rates in the G7. And while former Minister Flaherty did not manage to balance the budget following the financial crisis of 2008, the books that he produced will likely be in the black in the near future.
Two deaths in tragic Seattle News helicopter crash. Shortly after taking off from a helipad it has been refueling at, a KOMO News helicopter crashed into a busy intersection in the heart of Seattle, killing two and seriously injuring another. City officials are still unsure as to what caused the crash, but have announced that, in response to the incident, they will be reviewing the regulations surrounding helipads in the city.
Those are your UBC campus, local, and national headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
On Tuesday, March 25th at the Cobalt, CITR and Timber Concerts present Perfect Pussy. Pussy will be joined by special guests Vision. Advanced tickets are available at Zulu Records and Red Cat Records or online at ticketweb.ca. For more information, go to timberconcerts.com. Book the date. On March 28th and 29th, celebrate the UBC Bookstore's new space. Join the new release party. On March 28th, enjoy breakfast with free coffee followed by UBC Bhangra, Poetry Slam, the Thunderbird Dance Team, Missy D and Lady Jams, and UBC Acapella. On March 29th, enjoy music, giant games, face painting, balloon twisting, and kids authors. There will be free food throughout both days, prizes, giveaways, and discounts. Take part in MEC's spin class, backpacking talk, and run clinics for free. The first 50 guests receive a $20 gift card on March 28th, and the first 20 customers receive a $10 gift card on March 29th. For more information, go to bookstore.ubc.ca, and don't forget to book the date.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have Karina Bism's segment discussing the TED Talks, which have been live streaming this week in Irving K. Barber Learning Center here at UBC. She spoke with students at the live streams, as well as Haley Froese, who helped organize the TEDx Terry Talks.
So we're here at the Irving K. Barber Library at UBC listening to the live stream of the TED Talks 2014. It's the 30th year anniversary of TED Talks, and they've decided to bring it to Vancouver, so woo! I'm currently at the WISH program of the section, and Speakers include Zach Ibrahim, peace activist, an interview with Bill and Melinda Gates, Charmian Gooch, who is the recipient of the TED Wish this year, and she's been given $1 million to make her wish come true of eliminating and making illegal the processes of establishing anonymous companies. The audience is currently being serenaded by Sting with songs from his new Broadway musical, The Last Ship. Oh, please state your name and why you came to the TED Talk.
My name is Yoshi. I'm from Japan. And why I came to here is I am interested in seeing the TED Talk. I can see their idea through the TED Talk.
Do you watch a lot of TED Talks?
Oh, yeah. I watched lots of TED Talks. Because it's very good way to study English through the TED Talk. Yeah.
Could you please state your name and faculty?
So my name is Joanne, and I'm in the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences.
So what brought you out to view the TED Talks today, and specifically this program, the WISH program?
It was probably to see Bill and Melinda Gates, and then also to see the TED Prize winner, what her talk was going to be like, and what her wish was.
So what would you say was your favorite part?
I think my favorite part was actually the first speaker. That kind of surprised me. It was very very personal, and it was very, I think, very brave of him to share his story, but also very encouraging.
That was my favorite part, too. Do you watch a lot of TED Talks? Do you find yourself always inspired by them and just looking for new ideas after you watch them?
Yeah, I feel like if, you know, I have the break, depending on my study schedule, I'll try and check every day their new talk. And, you know, if it's something of interest, I will watch it. Some of them are inspiring. You know, I try and pick and choose. And it definitely, you know, afterwards you do kind of feel motivated to try and do something new.
So productive study breaks. I love it. I'm not going to lie. These were the first TED Talks I've ever watched.
Oh, really?
Sad, I know.
They're so good.
So one final question.
Yeah.
Just a little bit of a soul searcher. If you were to do a TED Talk, what would you do?
Sometimes the thought of TED is supposed to be like the talk of your life. Maybe it would be something in the vein of The Power of Education. I think that's all that's really on my mind at the moment.
Okay, great. And any thoughts from you?
I actually don't know. I don't know where I'd start, to be honest. I think being involved in medicine, I'd probably try to tap into some sort of social responsibility when it comes to the practice of medicine, but I don't know where I'd begin within that realm, but probably somewhere in there.
All right, so could you please state your name and your faculty?
My name is Mercedes McGuire, and my faculty is London Food Systems.
Awesome. So what brought you out to the TED Talks tonight, and specifically the WISH program?
I actually really love TED Talks. I love what it stands for. I love what it does. And I love the kinds of people that it brings together. And so I decided to take this whole, the whole TED conference this week as if I was actually going to the conference and attend the sessions that seemed particularly interesting. So this one in particular, WISH, seems really interesting because it was about people articulating their dreams for the future and tapping into that desire and kind of like the potential to make that kind of thing happen as well.
Yeah, so I noticed you were taking notes. So is that for your own personal inspiration and creativity?
Yeah. Yep.
Nice. No, that it's nice to see people getting really involved with it and immersed into it, even if they can't go because a ticket is about $7,500 to the conference, but just seeing people involved is great. So who was your favorite speaker of the night, or who are you most excited to see or hear later in the week?
That is a good question. There's a lot of people that have that look really interesting, and so I think it's difficult to say, you know, who is your most interesting person, but it's more so like the synergy of all kinds of different people. Like when I was looking at the profiles of speakers, it's like philanthropists like Bill and Melinda Gates, who actually their talk was quite inspiring, but it's also like marine biologists, ecologists, like anthropologists, social scientists, business leaders, like technology specialists, and everything in between, poets. And so just, I think, like that diversity of people and different backgrounds, and it seems to better represent like this whole spectrum of society and this whole spectrum of potential in creating change. So all of them.
Perfect. And final question, it's a little bit of a soul searcher. Well, Digger, you have time. If you were ever given the opportunity to give a TED Talk, what
what would it be about? Like, what kind of topic would it surround?
If I were to have an opportunity to give a TED Talk, I would talk about innovating new systems and structures that connect nations in the world in a more equitable way and move towards creating a new future. What I mean by that is multifaceted. Like, I would talk about finding your purpose. I would talk about each individual person going on a journey to discover, like, what it is that they're most passionate about and what it is that they really care about, and then tapping into that and doing that. And I would talk about design, building and designing new systems that create a more equitable world, create a world where there's access to health, there's access to opportunities for everyone, a world where we tackle things like racism and we tackle things like poverty, we tackle things like corruption. I would talk about so many things. I would talk about creating new things. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, seems like you are the ideal TED supporter. Thank you. So, could you please state your name and your relation to the TEDx Terry Talks?
Yeah, my name's Haley Froese, and I'm one of the two student assistants for the Terry Project, which is organizes the TEDx Terry Talks.
So can you please give a little bit of a distinction between the TED Talks, the TEDx Talks, and the TEDx Terry Talks?
Yeah, for sure. So TEDx means it's independently organized. That's what the X means. So we are somewhat affiliated to TED. And then the Terry Talks is because it's put on by the Terry Project, which is a UBC group. And so our talk is independently organized, and it's put on by the Terry Project, hence the long name.
And what exactly does the Terry Project do?
The Terry Project tries to foster interdisciplinary interaction between students at UBC and look at global issues. So we have a podcast, we have a bar talk series where we have panel discussions at the gallery, and we have this TEDx Terry Talk conference.
So how do you guys choose the speakers for the TEDx Terry Talks?
Anybody can apply. We have a grad student category, one alumni position, and then undergrad category, and people just submit a short video and an online application giving a brief idea of what they want their talk to be about, and then we try and balance it based on kind of arts and science and different people from different ages and different backgrounds.
Cool. When are those going on this year?
Yeah, the next conference will be in November, so applications usually open in September and close at the end of September, and we have a full month of practice and preparation.
Very nice. So, I don't know, have you been keeping up with this year's TED Talks in Vancouver?
Briefly, yeah. I haven't really seen any of the ones online, but I think I'm going to go later in the week and look at some of the free screenings at UBC.
Okay, so which speaker were you most interested in hearing?
Well, I missed it yesterday, but Bill and Melinda Gates I really wanted to see for sure. And my friend said that Chris Hadfield is pretty amazing. So.
Yeah, I went to the Wish section yesterday, and Bill and Melinda Gates had their interview. It was really good. And I actually wanted to talk to you about that a bit. So someone was given a wish. So Charmian Gooch, she was given a wish to end the legality of anonymous organizations because that's caused a lot of corruption in the world. And I just found it really cool. There was a big brainstorming session, and there were world leaders in the audience and company leaders just offering all of their services, saying, I'll pay for that. I'll make a movie about that. I'll do this. So can you give a bit of insight into how the Terry Talks helps facilitate this kind of collaborative process at UBC?
Yeah, well, I think definitely to a smaller degree. But there's a real bond that happens between the speakers. We had 11 speakers this year from all different years and different faculties, and it was really cool to see the connections that they made. Also, it's really great to see the connection between the audiences, audience members, because it's a full-day conference, so people interact between sessions. They start talking to their neighbor. We also have an atrium at lunch where a whole bunch of different student clubs and groups get to have a showcase, which fosters a lot of dialogue as well.
Nice. So I personally think it's a brilliant idea. I haven't really heard of many universities that do this. And university was like originally a place where theorists would come and share their thoughts and ideas. So do you think that this kind of programming should be integrated into like school structures and curriculums?
I think it's such an amazing opportunity because there is an element of theory. Like we had a physicist that talked about a really complicated scientific concept, but we also had someone talk about, you know, their personal relationship with their mom and their summer experience working in Uganda. And so I think having a range of experience in this format that's really accessible to everyone, because it's, you know, 17-minute talk, is really important. And yeah, but and more people should do it for sure.
I agree. So last question. If you were to do a TED Talk, or I don't know if you have you?
No.
If you were to do one, what would you do it about? What would you talk about?
Oh, putting me on the spot.
Kind of a soul searcher.
Yeah, I don't know. I think maybe my going on my experience on exchange last year, and maybe talk about a personal experience about that, or something related. I'm a poli sci major, so maybe something related to that. But I think that's why I was behind the scenes, is I don't I didn't have a crazy story to share.
Very cool. Where did you go on exchange?
I was in France, in Grenoble, in the Alps.
I love France. I love the Alps.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Karina. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
I was a prisoner.
I was a prisoner.
I was a prisoner of cocaine.
Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my dreams. It made me lie, steal.
Cocaine took my will, my soul.
And all I wanted was more cocaine. Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
Contact Cocaine Anonymous toll-free by calling 866-662-8300 or find them online at ca-bc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Next up on today's program, we have today's episode of Hot Topic. This week's Hot Topic is on the recent coalition of groups and journalists that are challenging a law based in Idaho, known as the AG Gag Law. Similar laws have been passed in six other states in USA, and the law basically makes it possible for anyone who secretly films or records animal abuse to be jailed for up to a year. Reporter Christine Kim asked UBC students whether or not they thought this law was a restriction on the freedom of speech. Take a listen.
Hi there. So first, just give me your name, your year, and your faculty.
I'm Nelly, first year arts.
Recently, there's been a group of journalists and activists that are petitioning against a law that was passed in Idaho that makes it legal for somebody to be jailed up to a year if they record or film animal abuse without permission. So for yourself, to what extent do you think that this is impeding on someone's right to free speech?
I don't know.
I think free speech is definitely important, especially in a place that's established based on democracy. But at the same time, I think there should be limits to appropriation on how you choose to like use that right that you have. So I guess in terms of this case, I think it's not necessarily impeding on free speech, at least not for the animals, right? I think it's more like privacy. And I think that's also another important issue that needs to be evaluated.
Yeah. Do you think this law is going to detrimentally decrease the amount of animal rights activism that we see? Because this is the seventh state to actually pass this law. So, yeah, how do you think this is going to impact, you know, animal rights activism?
I think it might actually push animal rights activists to, like, a more extreme end. Because at least from the cases that I've seen in a lot of different topics, it's like the more you push something, the more you try to suppress them, the more it'll come bounce back at you. And I feel like it'll push animal activism to, like, a more extreme end, which might or might not be effective. It's like, you know, when you try to hit two stones together, they don't really produce anything. They just break, both of them.
So what's your name and your faculty and your year of study?
Sean, science first year.
So recently there's been a coalition of journalists and they're fighting against a law passed in Idaho that basically says any recording or reports on animal abuse that was made without permission, you can be jailed for up to a year. To what extent do you think that's impeding on somebody's freedom of speech?
Sounds like a lot. I mean, wouldn't, like, I don't know a lot about American, like, politics or anything, but isn't there, like, something in the Constitution that ensures their freedoms of speech, I guess? Yeah. There should be something. Yeah, that sounds pretty unconstitutional to me, but I wouldn't know, so.
For yourself, do you think there's any need to protect somebody's privacy in this kind of case?
Yeah, they should have some sort of privacy. I mean, you can't just, like, go all up in someone's, like, stuff like that. But at the same time, journalistic independence is important because it allows people to, it exposes people to certain perspectives that might differ from their own. So it's pretty important to have that. But at the same time, like, farmers should have the right to deny, like, or at least deny, like, within their right to deny. Like, you can't stop someone from saying what they want to say, but you can stop them from, like, coming to, like, knocking on your door every day, stuff like that, like, trying to get opinions and stuff. I don't know. Yeah.
Please just first give me your name, your faculty, and your year of study.
Navi, arts first year.
So recently there's been a coalition of journalists that are fighting against a law that was passed in Idaho that basically jails someone for up to a year if they record or film any examples of animal abuse without permission. To what extent do you think that's impeding on freedom of speech?
I think that they have a right to fight for that because it is a sense of cruelty, whether it is towards a human or whether or not, and it's caught on tape. It does have, I mean, some people may not see it as the same sense because, like, they might not see animals in the same way, but I mean, it should have some punishment. The extent of years or what, how many of them use to get jailed, I mean, that could be debated over, but there should be some punishment for sure.
Do you think such a law is going to stop animal activism to a large extent, or do you think it's going to propel it even further forward?
I know that, like, from previous studies just on any criminal activities and stuff, if you tend to punish people more, like, there is that ripple effect that people, it works to an extent, but then it ends up even worsening it. So there is that factor that it could, like, backfire even. So yeah, but I think that it could work too, you know, to the start of it, if the punishment is appropriate, if it's right, it would definitely help prevent it.
So please just first give me your name and your faculty and your year of study.
So I'm Diane, I'm in science and biology student.
So recently a group of journalists are fighting against a law passed in Idaho that basically jails somebody for up to a year if they record or film any examples of animal abuse without permission. So in your opinion, to what extent does that restrict freedom of speech?
No, I think that's good because I don't think people would want to see acts of animal abuse, so why would they? I think that law is good so that even if it limits freedom of speech, I mean, no one really wants to see animals dying or getting beaten up, right? So, yeah, that's what I think.
All right. And do you think that this is going to impede on animal rights activism to a large extent?
I don't think it will because there are other means of looking at animal cruelty besides video or media, right? So, I don't think it'll impede any of them. Yeah.
Thank you, Christine. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
I went to residential school. I was just 8 years old.
Gayla Kaslaw,
My name is Gennarji O'Sullivan of the Tlalitsis Nation, originally from Turner Island. You're listening to Window, exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools.
This PSA was cut from a rally called Honor the Apology in Ottawa, Ontario. Those speaking are Clayton Thomas Mueller, Melody McIver, and Jocelyn Ayatoll.
Today, across this country they call Canada, is a day where we're asking for truth to come to the surface so that we can actually begin a conversation about reconciliation. Today, Canadians, newcomers, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples from all walks of life and religious denominations will reflect upon the impacts of Canada's residential schools. The burden of this experience has been on your shoulders for far too long. The burden is properly ours as a government and as a country. There is no place in Canada for the attitudes that inspired the Indian residential school system to ever again prevail. You have been working on recovering from this experience for a long time, and in a very real sense, we are now joining you on this journey. That was Stephen Harper in 2008. Unfortunately, the burden of this experience has not been shared. We believe it is time for us to all face what happened during one of the most violent policies in this country's history. We believe it is time to take a journey of honesty together. We now know that there is tangible violations of the Geneva Code on Genocide, that this country has committed crimes of genocide unequivocally against Indigenous peoples.
When we speak to the residential school, when we speak to the 60 scoop, when we speak to the day school, we speak it about it as if it's in the history. But our children are dying and suffering.
You have just heard At Window, exploring the legacy of Indian residential schools. Both my mother and I attended St. Michael's Residential School in Alert Bay, BC. This is a part of a larger project called Resonating Reconciliation that engages community radio as a tool to help define what reconciliation is. Resonating Reconciliation is meant to help reconcile all Canadians to this shared history. This is the work of the National Campus and Community Radio Association, the Red Jam Slam Society, and this station. Resonating Reconciliation is also supported by the Indian Residential School Survivor Society and is funded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To hear more, go to www.ncra.ca/resonating.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thanks for being with us. Our next feature segment is Morme Zanke's report on the Fukushima disaster and its relationship to Relay for Life. This piece was supposed to air last week, but unfortunately it was missed. Here is Morme's report.
Hello, my name is Morme Zanke, and today I'm going to talk a little bit about the Fukushima nuclear disaster and the residual effects that disaster has had on the Japanese population. So, Tuesday, March 11th, was the third anniversary of the catastrophe, where 15,884 people died and 2,636 were never found. I particularly want to focus on how the government has responded to the nuclear disaster and what they've done to try to repair the environment there. Right now, there are still 270,000 refugees, and 100,000 of those live still in improvised homes. And since the catastrophe, 3,000 people have died from medical problems or committed suicide. So the question that a lot of people are asking right now is, what has the government done to help these people? They still have $30 million unspent, and how has it helped survivors? It does not seem like they have used the money to their best of their ability to help the people who really need it. There has obviously been a lot of help with clearing the debris, but as far as building homes for these survivors, that's questionable. And we see this happening a lot with natural disasters that occur in the world. For example, in Haiti, the earthquake that happened in 2010. Right now in 2014, there are still a lot of things that need to be done. Yes, we've improved considerably, but 150,000 people still live in temporary homes in Haiti. And the government hasn't necessarily done anything about that. And I think that that's significant. And so I think what happens a lot in the public sphere is that the event happens and donations pour in from around the world. We really want to help these countries in need that have these problems, and that's a very good thing that we should be proud of. But I think over time, as things usually go, we forget a little bit about what's happening in these countries, and I think it's good to be reminded about the effects and kind of keep the government in check a little bit with how they're spending the money and what they're doing to improve the conditions. So looking at the situation objectively, going back to the Fukushima disaster, I think the main thing that the government is lacking, also in Haiti actually, is a connection with their people. I think also with the people who've donated, there is that sort of gap, that lack of connection between what cause we're donating to and where we are in the world. Yeah, we see horrifying images, people in need, and we do feel that need to donate. At that moment, there is that urgency, but as I said, over time, that urgency fades and we kind of get caught up in our own bubble, in our own lives, and we don't see the need to follow up with that. And I think the follow-up is the most important thing to sustain that connection and to create a meaningful relationship between the donors and the recipients who use that money to try to improve their particular situation. So linking this back to UBC and the community here, I think that an organization that does do this kind of follow-up and has a connection with their donors is the Canadian Cancer Society. Recently on campus, we had a Relay for Life where students and other people from the community came in and stayed up for 12 hours without sleep as sort of like a fundraising event for the Canadian Cancer Society. There were games and activities, and it was a great way for people just to be together and remember their loved ones and people that they knew who were affected by cancer. And so I just wanted to highlight experiences that some of the participants of Relay for Life had, and so we're going to hear a few people speak about their experience.
I heard about the event from my floormate, and at first I was a bit reluctant because I was wondering how they're going to connect kind of walking all night with cancer, and so I didn't really know how they were going to do that, but I was pleasantly surprised when I got to the event because I think everyone just really wanted to be there, and it was a good group, and I think they did a good job balancing, I guess, the fun and, like, the seriousness of the issue, and I think they did a good job, like, emphasizing the cause and, like, presenting survivor stories and stuff like that. Felt like I was part of something because they revved you up and they got everyone kind of excited at the beginning, and they also had a group of survivors and they had one of them speak to us at the beginning of the event. So I think that was good because it was kind of a reminder of why we were all getting together.
Okay, so when I did Relay for Life this past few weeks, I really enjoyed my experience. I thought it was a great event, and everyone who attended just, like, was so inspiring and, like, so much spirit and enthusiasm. It really got me thinking about, like, how many people around me were, like, so closely affected by cancer, which I was kind of, like, unaware of, I suppose, before. So I thought the event itself was super good, and, like, the Canadian Cancer Society, I think everybody knows somebody or knows of somebody who's been affected by cancer, and I think it's really important to, like, raise the money, as, like, we raised quite a bit, and I think that was good.
So, listening to those two girls, I think the general kind of feeling was that they were a little bit tentative at first, but as our first speaker said, were pleasantly surprised. The Canadian Cancer Society really makes an effort to connect with people. which is why I think they have been so successful. You can hear from these testimonies that they felt that it was really a good cause, they felt a part of something, and they felt like they were doing something good for the community and for something that they believed in. And so I think, kind of tying this back to the Fukushima disaster, what that government is lacking is, I think, the connection to the people that they're trying to help and the donors. In order for it to be successful, I think there are sort of a few factors that need to come into play. I think you need to let the world know what is happening, which happens, but then it sort of gradually fades off. And I think that needs to be sustained, and the world needs to be kept aware of these things. And then another factor is a connection between the government and the people that they are trying to help out of their situations. And I think that's lacking. You know, we see it in the Fukushima disaster and in Haiti. People are forgotten a little bit, and this is terrible. People are still living in squalid conditions from these disasters, and nothing is being done to help them. And so, as we've seen through Relay for Life, obviously this is a different kind of cause, but that connection is there. And I think if that was sustained and people still saw what was happening in Fukushima and in Haiti, perhaps governments would be pressured to do more, maybe more donations in the case of Haiti that's needed would be presented, and solutions could happen and lives could be improved. So yeah, I just want to talk a little bit about that this week, seeing as how the anniversary of Fukushima was on Tuesday. That's all I have to say on that. Thank you for listening. Have a great night.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Max Nominacher.
And I'm Karina. For our next segment on the show, we have Alasdair Melling, who hosts a report and roundtable on frustrations and compromises with the English language.
Okay, I need a mic. Thank you
very much. Okay, so I wanted to start this off because I think English is one of the most adaptable languages that seems to exist, because there's many reasons why, but I would compliment the... Is this okay?
Yeah, it's fine.
The mic? Uh-huh, uh-huh. Okay, technical difficulty over. So, the OED, which stands for those of you educated ones, which you should all be if you're listening to CITR, obviously. The OED is the Oxford English Dictionary, the more superior version of any dictionary. Not that, you have Webster's here? Is it Webster's?
Yes.
Webster's. And you have a number of others. But the OED, the most official one and the most complete. So it added last year 900 words. I think it adds words every quarter throughout the year, but in the most recent quarter, pardon me, it added 900 words. Now, these included selfie, TikTok, bestie, honk, and four versions of that infamous word that I can unfortunately not say on the radio, but the one between rhyming with punt or... But yeah, so punty, punting, various words like that. They actually added it, which I think feminists were very, very excited about, because... it seemed to sort of get rid of the stigma. And later I'm going to be talking a little bit about swear words and what you think of swear words and why are they so horrible to say, because they're just words in the end, and we're not really thinking of the punt when we say it genuinely. I mean, you don't really picture that. So we are becoming ever, and that's one of the things, like if you add selfie, TikTok, bestie, honk, it really honestly sounds like it's becoming, OED is becoming increasingly more similar to the Urban Dictionary. But the thing is, for me, it shows the ability to change, and I really like this flexibility, because you don't get it with other languages. You don't get it with, so for example, Spanish, they have the Real Academia Española, which means the Royal Academy Spain, not a Spanish Academy, actually, and they very strictly maintain the words, so they don't get to add it. Same with thing with the French, they don't like many words coming in, so they sort of try and keep away any English words and invent their own words, sort of keep out the English influence, the pompous bees, I can say, or Astrids. And I was wondering...
Got a lot of words yourself, Alistair.
So, yeah, they keep they're very, very rigorous. And on the other hand, because we've got so many different dictionaries that dictate our languages, the English language, we're a lot more, adaptable. And I think... What I wanted to ask you guys, seeing as you're all foreign, we've got a Serbian, you're of Serbian descent, or you're born, you actually are Serbian, Romanian and German, true German, very nice. You can't see the hair right now, but it's glorious.
It is blonde.
Like a nice sunny day. Anyway, so one thing I wanted to ask you guys is, what kind of words would you like to add to the English language? What frustrations do you have? Because there is actually one rather humorous one that I came across called Gastival, which is the period of time between when a relationship starts and you first openly fart in front of your
wait, what is it?
Gastival. From Gastival. Gas and interval.
Oh my gosh. Oh, perfect.
No.
Gastival is a festival in Sweden where couples come for their first date. So what would we add?
What would you find? Because I'm going to add a serious note. I really get frustrated with the fact that we don't have a... first of all, it comes from the fact that we don't have a you and a you plural. So you singular, you plural. Mm-hmm. And then that doesn't cause too many problems, because in spoken language we can say you guys, y'all, if you're in the... I don't like that at all. But,
y'all.
We've got many ways in spoken word and descriptive language. We've got many ways to get around it. But we do not have any way to get there. So there... masculine, sorry, they're singular and they're plural, and I get really frustrated about this. I was writing recently and I couldn't work out, because I didn't
wait, what's their singular?
So well, it's his and her, but if you want to be general, mm-hmm. It's really annoying saying his / her, or and then
okay.
You risk this whole sexist
gender
kind of
yeah
thing,
okay,
if you say his and then it sounds completely weird if you say her, if you're just trying to talk generally about one specific person. So I would like a singular and a... Obviously, something that's considered completely gender neutral, rather than there. Because there you sort of kind of get the sense of... It's not a defined thing. So I would add something that...
Is that a new word, though? Or is that
a
new
word.
Way...
It's something I would personally add. Because I get very frustrated when I'm writing. And I can't... when I'm trying to give examples of things, I can't use their singular and their plural. And it's also kind of confusing for us, because we have, when we use he, his and her, this, like, for example, the Spanish, the French, I think I can assume for the Romanian language.
That's Serbian, yeah. You do, there's a you and a plural you.
Yeah, and I believe actually you guys have, correct me if I'm wrong, for Serbian, you have three different ways of saying we. Sorry, we're like I. So, yeah. What did I say? You have I.
Yeah.
Then we have we, which is one and which is two people. And then you have we, which is a group more than two people.
I don't think we have that.
It's in Slovenian. And
okay.
I know it's in Croatian. I'm not entirely sure about
Well,
Serbian.
If it's in Croatian, it's in Serbian. It's basically the same language, but I think...
It's kind of interesting, because you have...
Me.
Me.
Svi.
Oh, I guess. There are three, but it's not like a one word. It's like saying you guys. It's not... It's like all of us, yeah. Kind of.
So I, then I could say myself and
me,
you.
Us.
So us.
And then there's
and
like
then,
me, svi, that's like all of us.
All of us. That's kind of cool. I like that. But then you've got to conjugate it all differently, as appropriately, because you've got the three.
Well, we have seven cases.
Oh,
as opposed. Okay, as opposed to English, which has like hardly, I don't know how many it has, but there's a lot more conjugation than normal.
I did notice. So, any frustrations on your part for the English language? There's obviously
Costa and I have, we've already spoken about this before in the newsroom, like had a really long conversation about the word antipatičan or antipatična for girl or guy, which basically means like someone who just, you just don't like them because there's something not...
It's like antipathetic, but like if that was like a, if antipathetic was like a word generally used, which it's not in the English language. Nobody says antipathetic. I'm not even sure if that's an actual word.
No.
So
well, I think it is a word.
Literally translated, it would mean antipathetic.
But it just doesn't have the same ooze, and there's something that you can really explain by saying that person was antipatičan. Like people just understand what you mean.
Oh, yeah, I
know. It's not. It's not like you. Yeah, there's not really, I guess, a way of saying it. And we talked about this just like a week ago. How much we wish that there was a word like that in English, so we could explain to people like, what is it about that person? Well, they're just antipatičan. You know, like
in German you say unsympathisch, and that's kind of.
Okay.
Same thing.
Interesting.
Like, yeah, that's true. You cannot really say that in English.
Yeah.
there's another word in Brazilian. I spent a year in Brazil, so those who didn't know. And there was one word that I thought was absolutely brilliant, safado. Now, it means shameless. But like that's the only way they can translate it. But you can say it for anything. Like if somebody's being greedy, if someone's looking at a girl in a particular way, if your friend, for example, I'll give you an example, in a club, if you notice your friend and a girl walks by and you notice I'm talking from a guy's point of view, and you notice your guy friend sort of looking at the girl as he walks by. I mean, you can't really say in it. There's not a word in English you can say, but you would say in Portuguese, "Ah, seu safado." Or seu safadinho, which is like a little shameless, if it's not that bad. But you can just shout that every single way, and it means like you. It doesn't,
you're so shameless.
No, there's no word.
Yeah, shameless. English does really miss out on a lot of really cool sayings. Like, I don't know, I think there's a thing in French. I forget what it is, but it's basically you say it when you're having a conversation with someone. And you know when you have a conversation with someone and you finish the conversation, it feels like you just wanted to say one more thing or something was missing in that conversation. There's a word for that in French. I forget what it is. And it is so true. Like something that happens in everyday life. Like you have a conversation with someone and you're like, you like leave that person, you guys walk away, but you should have said that one thing or they could have said that one thing and it just wasn't complete. So you can't really say that in English. There's no word for that.
So many great idioms in English.
True.
You'll have you guys seen that? There's a great YouTube clip of a guy talking about the idiom to shoot fish in a barrel, and he's just so confused by it. Anyways, for our listeners,
fish in a
to shoot shooting fish in a barrel. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Oh,
it means it's very easy. Like shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, and this guy just gets so frustrated trying to understand this idiom. Anyways, I recommend it to all our listeners at this moment. Go do yourselves a favor and check out the YouTube video. Guy gets frustrated explaining the idiom to shoot fish in a barrel.
Yeah.
But there's idioms in every language. Like, I remember you telling me the Serbian idiom to throw off his bacati pegle, which is like to throw irons, like ironing.
Yeah, I was in Belgrade last time. One of my friends, we were going to go to a concert. One of my friends said, "Watch out!" He literally translated from Serbian. "Watch out! People are going to be throwing irons," and I was terrified. People are going to be what? Yeah, he had to talk me down from that one.
There's something, Max. I like this the German word.
You mean Schadenfreude?
Schadenfreude
is the schönste Freude. It means like the joy of somebody else's failure is like the yeah, that's kind of the mean Germans. Yeah, laughing at somebody if somebody fails. But like it's not so mean. It's like
it's a good word to know though.
Uh-huh. Well, no, you do. Wait, everyone laughs at that. I mean, what do you call fail videos? You see the fail videos? You know the fail videos?
Yeah, like,
oh, yeah.
That's exactly Schadenfreude. That's Schadenfreude at its best.
There's some very good swearing sayings in Romanian that I can't express on air. But there's just some great ways of insulting people in that I just haven't found an equivalent in English.
Yeah. The F word just doesn't do it sometimes. Like,
yeah,
there's so many other things
so
you can say in
different.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just more common in English to swear all the time. So
that's true.
That's what I find. And so if you
swear more.
Yeah.
I don't know.
There's no imagination in it.
Yeah.
You got to spend time at the Serbian Community Center to learn what swearing really is.
you can like F anything from anybody. You can.
Bavarian is really good in swearing.
I did hear that the Slovenian, they don't have any swear words. I mentioned Slovenian because it's geographically close to.
We keep telling Alistair.
They don't
not
have
Slovenian.
Any swear words. So they would say something like, "May your sprouts rot," which is one of the worst ways you can say. Or you can say to somebody, I think, don't, if there are any Slovenians, which I doubt because you're such a tiny population, you can say letter to somebody, and that's swearing at somebody, just saying letter. I'm not entirely sure, but it's something to do with just saying the word letter to them, and that's apparently offensive, but
weird.
May all your sprouts rot.
We apologize to all our Slovenians.
Slovenians. But that's the thing. I really wish we could be less, because some people are very sort of hesitant against adding words to the English. So if you ask my grandmother, she's extremely, extremely conservative. So she will still say, she'll still use the word gay in the sense of, oh, that was such a gay day today. Like, genuinely, we still use the word fag is a cigarette, and queer, we actually don't really think of that as being the sort of North American meaning. Queer is still, for us, weird. okay. something that's very weird. But my grandmother will still say, pardon? Like, surfing around with an, what you call the emphasis on the end, pardon?
Oh,
she will okay. genuinely say that. But, sorry, or what did you say? My grandmother is extremely conservative, so she will not let any of these words sort of come into our language, which is actually really a shame, because languages do shape the way you think, and it is entirely because of that. But I think we have to wrap up, do we? What's the time right now?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, we are just going to be finishing up right now.
Okay.
And go ahead, Max.
So it's my turn. That's our program for today.
It's under one aspect.
Yeah. As you already know, my name is Max, and today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you would like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email news@citr.ca. You can also subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Max.
And I'm Karina. Today's show is produced by Nina. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening.
Thank you.
And stay tuned for Stranded, up next right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
like a snake calling on a phone. I've got no time to be alone. Summer coming at me all the time. You better think I lose my mind. Cause I'm stranded on my own. Stranded far from home. Alright.
All right. You're listening to CITR Radio